Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Genève Montri of Amnesty International, who discusses his group's new report titled New Order, Same Abuses, which highlights concerns about the torture of Iraqi prisoners. Julia Harumi Moss, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, who assesses the consequences of a federal court's dismissal of a lawsuit filed by former CIA prisoners who assert they were brutally tortured, and Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy, who examines the connection between the emergence of blatant Islamophobia and Republican political strategy in advance of this November's midterm election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton surprised many diplomats when she compared the bloody drug war in Mexico to the long-running leftist insurgency in Colombia. At its peak in the 1990s, leftist rebels in Colombia, funded through drug trafficking, controlled 40% of that South American country. The insurgency has weakened since former President Alberto Uribe launched a brutal crackdown against leftist rebel groups like the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Clinton is now urging Mexico, the United States, and Central American countries to launch a planned Colombia-style program to fight drug traffickers in Mexico. Bloodshed in Mexico's drug war has killed over 28,000 people since 2006. Plan Colombia has been criticized for its heavy use of military force, spraying of toxic herbicides to flush out guerrillas, reliance on American military advisors, and resulting human rights abuses. In her speech before the Council on Foreign Relations, Clinton claimed the Mexican government faces a well-organized network of drug traffickers analogous to a political insurgency. Prior to Clinton's speech, the State Department avoided any talk of an insurgency in Mexico. The Calderón government rejected the comparison with Colombia, asserting that it is resisting penetration by the drug cartels and reforming the police. In recent months, the Obama administration has made a dramatic shift in its policy on deporting undocumented immigrants. The Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, has sought to refocus enforcement on those who have committed serious crimes rather than conducting broad sweeps of illegal immigrants. According to the investigative website ProPublica, top ICE administrators have urged immigration agents to use more discretion in detaining long-time law-abiding residents, juveniles, family members of U.S. citizens, veterans, and members of the armed forces. An internal memo leaked in July discussed ways the administration could relax enforcement against select groups like college students and spouses of military personnel if Congress fails to pass comprehensive immigration reform. In addition, ICE has begun to dismiss deportation cases against people with active pending immigration cases who have not committed a serious crime. Administration critics, including anti-immigrant Republicans like Iowa Congressman Steve King, have blasted these policy changes. Over the last decade, the number of deportations has doubled to nearly 400,000 a year. According to researchers at Syracuse University, immigrants now wait an average of a year and a half for their cases to be heard in immigration court. Ruful Ali is a second-generation Bangladeshi immigrant who works as an accountant in London and commutes from a comfortable suburb. He is part of a new generation of Muslims in Europe who seek normalcy with good jobs, kids, schools, and local sports. But the quiet life is becoming less accessible to Muslims in Europe as the political environment grows increasingly hostile to Islam. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the anti-Islamic backlash in Europe includes a recent referendum passed in Switzerland that bans minarets on mosques and a Belgian prohibition on women wearing burqas, with a similar proposal now pending in France. Ali, the middle-class accountant, says the backlash is driven in part by violent images of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Taliban. "That is how we are seen. It is sad," he says. "We would like to showcase who we are in a good way." University of Chicago doctoral student Daniel Laban, who has studied the growing Islamophobia, says the current anti-Muslim movement in the United States is a combination of American nativism and European anti-jihadist ideology. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Amnesty International released a new report on September 12th titled, New Order, Same Abuses, Unlawful Detentions and Torture in Iraq, which highlights concerns about the treatment of Iraqi prisoners now under the control of Iraqi security forces after the U.S. transferred their authority to the Baghdad government. Through interviews gleaned from former prisoners and others, the report focuses on many kinds of abuse, including detainees being subjected to beatings, suspension by their limbs, electric shock, suffocation, threats of rape, arbitrary arrest, and being held without charge or trial. Amnesty estimates that 30,000 detainees are currently being held without trial in Iraq. More than 400 detainees were held in a secret prison at the old Mutana airport, whose existence was revealed publicly in April 2010. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Genève Montri, Amnesty International's Government Relations Director for Terrorism and Counterterrorism. He describes how the report was compiled and explains what Amnesty hopes will happen as a result to protect the rights of Iraqis regardless of their guilt or innocence for the crimes they are accused of committing.
Because of the nature of this subject and the security situation, a number of interviews were actually conducted in Iraq. Some were conducted over the phone, and some were actually conducted by Iraqis that had been forced out, part of the refugee population or part of the larger population that is now in surrounding countries. Some of the core facts are frankly just not known. I mean, one of the facts is just how many people are being held. And we have an estimate that 30,000 people are being held without charge. But clearly, because we aren't going to be able to verify that from the Iraqis, and the Iraqis aren't able to verify that, the real number remains unknown. Frankly, it's very difficult to get accurate information from the authorities, who will always say, look, these populations are shifting and changing, and it's a complex situation, those kinds of things. A subset of these people were frankly picked up by the Americans some time ago and held without charge, and some of them were actually recommended for release by the Americans, but under the Status of Forces Agreement, both the prisons and the prison population had to be turned over to the Iraqi authorities. And so we're still dealing with the legacy of U.S. involvement in Iraq.
The U.S. behavior in Iraq regarding prisoners, it's a pretty low bar. Does the report then say that Iraqis who now have custody of their fellow Iraqi citizens are behaving even worse, and there's more torture and more deaths among this population?
Well, I think it's a complex picture. I think that by the time American forces were leaving in the last couple of years, you may have heard many stories about General Stone that went to Iraq, and actually by the time that he started his work and he was able to put in place a lot of very interesting reforms to actually get prisons in Iraq to a pretty good standard, where not only were they trying to separate the detainee population between those who were, say, hardcore extremists and those who were just randomly selected, but also running things like education programs, running things to allow people to develop vocational skills, so that you really didn't have a situation where people were being picked up and put into what he called extremist universities or jihadi universities, where they were going to be kicked out into the population in a much worse state than they were when they were picked up. Many were unable to read and write, and so they put in place programs to allow them to study and so that they weren't going to be radicalized inside these facilities. Unfortunately, in the process of leaving Iraq, just because of the Status of Forces Agreement and security situation, a lot of those programs are not going to be held in place for a long time, and you've got a situation where really you've got a continuing history really from a legacy of the Saddam era to kind of now. I mean, many people that are really, many of the abuses that you hear about from Iraqi facilities, you wouldn't be surprised if you heard those stories many, many years ago. And unfortunately, although, you know, these facts are difficult to get, they're so consistent, they're from so many sources, and they're from so many different organizations, that it's hard to say anything other than there is substantial reason to be concerned about these things. Not only random arrests, arbitrary arrests, abusive prisoners, extortion, corruption, a lack of access to lawyers. Many people have been abducted. Many people are being held without charge. And these are also people who have been held for some time, often years.
So is your goal to shed light on this and exert moral pressure on the Iraqis? There's hardly a functioning government there. So what do you think should or can happen?
You know, I think that there are a couple of things that really should happen. One is that the U.S., when it went into Iraq, or it goes into countries like this, basically turns their entire society upside down. And I think Colin Powell's rule applies, that if you break it, you own it. And we still, regardless of what the headlines may say, we still have an amazing authority on the ground, and we still have a considerable moral authority and responsibility for the things that are happening. The U.S. does have a very unique situation in Iraq in terms of its ability to influence the government, and it also has a responsibility for some of the abuses which remain. And I think the things that we're calling for really are that the Iraqi government, both because it inherited some obligations from the previous government, as well as the obligations it took on itself, has to comply with international law. And even the Iraqis' law that they recognize themselves, which is to say that they must release all detainees they're holding or charge them with recognizable offenses. That all aspects of torture or all use of torture and ill treatment have to be ended immediately and properly investigated. And anybody who's implicated has to be brought to justice. They have to ensure that anybody that's picked up and is questioned has an access to a lawyer and is brought in front of a judge, which Iraqi law demands. And they have to allow for a proper mechanism so that Iraqi detainees are able to challenge the legal basis of their detention. Unfortunately, another problem is that many people who are picked up are moved, and you can't tell where they're being held. Their families have no idea where they're being held. And they have to ensure that those who are being held are held in recognizable places of detention and are held within a regular authority. And unfortunately, many of the people conducted in these abuses are part of the Interior Ministry or the Ministry of Defense, and it's being done for sectarian reasons or quote-unquote security reasons.
That was Genev Montri of Amnesty International. Contact their Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-675-8754 or visit their website at amnesty.org, where you can read a copy of the New Order Same Abuses report. A federal appeals court ruled on September 8th that former prisoners held by the CIA could not proceed with a lawsuit over abuse and torture they claim they were subjected to in foreign prisons. The judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, by a 6-5 vote, dismissed a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of five former prisoners. The judges based their decision on the government's assertion under former President George Bush and President Barack Obama that permitting such a lawsuit would expose government secrets and endanger national security. The ACLU says they will appeal the case up to the Supreme Court. The lawsuit was filed against a Boeing Aircraft Company subsidiary, Jepson Data Plan Incorporated, which is accused of coordinating flights to move CIA-held prisoners overseas, where they were detained for interrogation under the government's Extraordinary Rendition Program. As a candidate, President Obama campaigned against Bush administration violations of civil liberties, but since taking office, he has embraced many of these same policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Julia Harumi Moss, staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California, who assesses the consequences of the judge's ruling that continues to prevent victims of CIA torture from seeking justice and accountability in U.S. courts.
The case was filed in 2007, in May of 2007, on behalf of five men who were, as I said, kidnapped by the CIA, forcibly disappeared into U.S.-run prisons overseas, and subjected to brutal torture. The reason we sued Jepson Data Plan, or the claims against this company, this Boeing subsidiary, are that the company knew or recklessly disregarded its role in facilitating torture. And we do have evidence that we allege in the complaint that Jepson knew about these CIA torture flights. They were actually referred to by company personnel as the torture flights. And the company made a handsome profit off of them. And so because of all of the roadblocks sort of that have continually been thrown up against getting accountability for the Bush administration's torture program, this was another attempt to try to bring justice for these men, for these victims of torture, and this time through holding another party responsible other than the U.S. government, namely this flight company that arranged the flights.
Julia, tell us a bit about one individual who is the lead plaintiff, Binyam Mohamed from Ethiopia. He was held something like 7 years and was, under his own testimony, subjected to extremely painful torture. I don't know how graphic we can get here, but maybe you can give our listeners a sense of what this man endured.
Yes. Binyam Mohamed is a 28-year-old Ethiopian citizen and resident of the United Kingdom. He was arrested in Pakistan on immigration charges and flown to Morocco. chained to the bottom of a plane and flown to Morocco, where then he was transferred to the custody of Moroccan security agents who subjected him to severe physical and psychological torture, including routine beatings, breaking his bones. They cut him with a scalpel all over his body, including on his genitals, and poured hot, stinging liquid into the open wounds. He was blindfolded and handcuffed while being subjected to extremely loud music day and night. He was held this way for 18 months in Moroccan custody, and then he was transferred back to American custody and flown to Afghanistan. He was detained there in Afghanistan in a CIA-run prison where he was kept in nearly permanent darkness and subjected to loud noise like the recorded screams of women and children for 24 hours a day. He wasn't fed regularly, and he lost 40 to 60 pounds in the 4 months that he was in Afghanistan. And ultimately, he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay, where he remained for nearly 5 years. Our courts so far have been closed to victims of torture, and national security has been thrown up as an obstacle to due process, essentially.
Julia, with this court decision, the ACLU is planning to appeal to the Supreme Court. Do you expect the Supreme Court to come down on your side on this? Is there any kind of track record among a fairly conservative court these days that suggests that this will be decided in favor of people having a day in court if they've been subjected to government torture?
We definitely are going to seek review in the Supreme Court. It's always difficult to predict what the Supreme Court will do with a case. This is an extremely important case, and the justices on the Supreme Court do have an understanding of the world that we live in, and I think they also understand that the rest of the world wants to know if the United States can hold people accountable for torture. If this case is allowed to stand, the United States will be known in the world as having closed its courtroom doors to torture victims while providing complete immunity to their torturers. And so, you know, we have every hope that the United States Supreme Court will take this very seriously and will reverse the decision of the Ninth Circuit here.
Candidate Obama, when he was running for the White House, had protested against the Bush administration's misuse of the secrecy doctrine to block the public from discovering government abuses during this war on terrorism. And I wonder, do you think President Obama has adequately explained his reversal, his very dramatic reversal, in embracing many of the same policies of the Bush administration in terms of secrecy and continuing programs like extraordinary rendition, and even now the Obama administration's targeting of an American citizen for assassination in Yemen?
I don't think you can explain it adequately. I mean, you can't explain it adequately because it's the wrong position. It's the wrong position that victims of torture should not be able to seek redress in court, and that the torturers shouldn't be held accountable through a thorough investigation. You know, it's the wrong answer to say that we should be able to target a U.S. citizen for killing without a hearing, without an indictment, without a jury of their peers. I think it would be impossible for him to adequately explain that change in position because the change in position was the wrong one.
What message does the United States send with this decision to countries where torture victims are trying to get justice and confront their torturers, confront their abusers?
So there are courts throughout the world which will continue to work to allow people to seek redress for torture and for international human rights violations, and then there are countries that won't. The message this sends to the world, if this decision is allowed to stand, is that the United States is one of the countries that doesn't, which is not what most of us want to believe about our country. So we do hope that the Supreme Court will reverse this decision and uphold our reputation in the world.
That was Julia Harumi Moss, staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California. To learn more about the group's lawsuit on behalf of torture victims, contact the ACLU at area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at aclu.org. the last several months, America has seen an explosion of hate and fear targeting Muslims at home and abroad. Conservative politicians and right-wing talk show hosts have led an ugly campaign to oppose the proposed location of an Islamic community center 2 blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. More recently, a little-known pastor in Florida threatened to burn the Muslim holy book, the Quran, on the 9th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks and received extensive coverage on cable TV news and talk radio, as well as international attention. Although the burning of the Quran was postponed, angry protests took place around the world, some of which turned violent, resulting in deaths and injuries in Afghanistan and Kashmir. Links between recent open displays of bigotry towards Muslims in the U.S. and this November's congressional midterm election can be seen in the comments of former GOP House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who has compared Muslims to Nazis and who said on September 11th that President Obama may follow a Kenyan anti-colonial worldview. An August poll by the Pew Research Center found nearly a third of conservative Republicans believe Obama is a Muslim. A CNN poll found that 41% of Republicans say Obama was definitely or probably not born in the U.S. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. He examines the connection between the emergence of blatant Islamophobia, Republican Party political strategy in advance of the upcoming midterm election, and the exclusion of Muslim voices in U.S. media.
I think there are lots of different layers to this, but I think that a substantial part of the right decides that, you know, that this is how they're going to try to, as they say, throw red meat to their base to try to get them all galvanized and make a lot of other people fearful and paranoid and so on shortly before an election. So I do think that that's part of it, but I think that there are, you know, deeper dynamics going on here. For one, there's this total long-term structural slant in terms of giving voice to the religious right and not the religious left, for, you know, to use a shorthand term of it. I mean, for example, right now you have 14 activists in the Nevada desert who are undergoing trial for having gone on to a U.S. military base to protest against bombings, drone bombings in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This Air Force base in Nevada is actually where some of the control of the drones takes place. That would seem to be, you know, a sensationalistic story, and a lot of these are religious activists and so on. You don't find stories like that, you know, getting attention, even though they're well-reasoned and, you know, have had some basis in them and so on and so forth. I also think that a deep-seated structural thing that leads to these periodic explosions is the lack of meaningful Muslim and other voices in the U.S. media.
Sam Husseini, what's the responsibility of news outlets when they cover something like this so-called pastor who's threatening to burn the Quran? He's got worldwide attention. People have died in demonstrations and riots in Afghanistan and other places. Similarly, you have former Speaker of the House, Republican Newt Gingrich, with presidential ambitions, going on the air comparing the entire Islamic religion to Nazis. At what point should the news outlets, make a determination, maybe this isn't news, maybe this is just somebody trying to get their 15 minutes of fame, or, in the case of Newt Gingrich, sell more books?
It's not covered in the same way as a scandalous statement, the Gingrich thing, for example, you know, likening Muslims to Nazis, basically. You know, contrast that with, you know, what Helen Thomas said. She basically got driven out of journalism for making remarks that she immediately apologized for, that some deemed, you know, were overly critical of Israel and so on. You know, I mean, there's a way that type of thing is framed that demands an apology, and that's not what we see. I mean, it's like, you know, some level of controversy around it, but it's, you know, in a context of, you know, publicizing Gingrich, either his possible run or, as you say, books. And not to say, you know, this is unacceptable, and if you want to pretend to be a reasonable political figure, you better shape up here. I don't think that's what we see in the general media discourse. And in terms of this Pastor Jones character, you know, it's like we all have to suddenly stop and, you know, have a discussion with a member of the Flat Earth Society. to try to convince them that this position might not be a reasonable one.
Sam, what's the connection, if any, between the widespread belief among conservatives and Republicans here in this country that Barack Obama is a Muslim with this seemingly concerted campaign to attack the entire Islamic faith?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of similar to the whole, he's a socialist thing. Never mind that, the policies are benefiting Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms. Never mind that he's, stepping up drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan and, which are, killing Muslims. This right-wing paranoia streak in the U.S. culture, what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics, it fundamentally knows no bounds. The centrist establishment, I think, tries to use it in some ways. And it also, on the other hand, tries to appease it, but there really is no appeasing it. I mean, now we're the Obama administration, it looks like, is going to try to sell, tens of billions of dollars worth of jet fighters to Saudi Arabia. And the way that this is all framed is either pro-Muslim or anti-Muslim. It's sort of besides the point. I mean, there's a tacit alliance between elites in the United States and the Saudi royal family and other elites that, the Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt, for example, and so on, that they basically oppress the, people in the region. I think more meaningful dynamics end up being obscured rather than being highlighted in how we look at this. The anti-Muslim bigotry, I think, in large part is used by the establishment, but the establishment goes after things for its own ends as it suits it.
That was Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Visit the Institute's website at accuracy.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.